Well, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Dan Renshaw, who has had quite a trip down from the mountain today. Dan, tell us about it.
I should have left a lot earlier. Yes, Mike, it was the last 24 hours we've had as close to a blizzard as you can get. High winds, a lot of snow. I actually had to cancel with you yesterday because I really didn't want to go out in it. And probably a wise thing to stay put. But toward the end of the storm, the winds let up and the last of the snow was able to accumulate. Probably a foot and a half at the goal cord. And then as you progress down the hill, notably near the Independence, it's probably a half that.
Okay.
And then less so on down. But it was a case of using skins downhill, breaking trail.
That is, I'm just thinking about that. I'm saying that must be energy draining.
Well, yeah. When we're done today, would you care for something to eat?
Sure. Well, let's see what we can do here.
Okay.
That happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I can make it through the program.
Okay. So that, you know, from time to time in the past, we have talked a little bit about climate change over perhaps, say, the last three quarter of a century. And I have just come across a couple of other references recently. They've looked at two different things happening in the state of Alaska. One, the permafrost, the change of permafrost in terms of an increased average temperature for the ground going up what appears to be a small amount, 3 or 4 degrees, but gradually reaching the point where the permafrost will melt and no longer be called perma. And secondly, and as significant, it seems, a gradual increase in the average temperatures of the air above the ground. So let's just touch upon it before we launch into a continuation of our discussion. Given there's a blizzard that happened, there's snow up there, last 50 years, your experience, what's going on?
Well, there's very definitely a change going on. If I remember correctly, when I think it was Captain Cook was at the mouth of Glacier Bay in the 1770s, thereabouts, the ice front was right there at the straits. All of Glacier Bay was full. And we don't know when the ice age really started melting away, warmer ambient everywhere. But it's a process that's been in process for a long time. I get so irritated listening to a lot of the debate over man-made global warming. Is there such a thing? Sure. Look, we're adding on to it with our activities, yes. But I have yet to see any science that I would agree with as to how big that amount is that we're adding to. For example, you know, every best reading I've been able to do is everywhere around the world, volcanoes that are above the level of the ocean, there's at any given moment, there's something like 30 of them that are in active process of belching out greenhouse gases,
sure,
along with a lot of other dust and dirt and so on, and throwing it way up in the atmosphere. And natural, you know, natural causes of all of these things, and then add on to that, how much is man contributing? Yes, he is. I don't want to say anything contrary, but the process has been there for a long time. In my observation, it has. I have noticed, for example, a gross change in the vegetation, especially in the Hatcher Pass area. It used to be that the south side of Marmot Mountain was nothing but open meadows. There was very little brush on Marmot Mountain, and the most beautiful meadows of wildflowers. Just unbelievably beautiful in the early summer. The brush has taken over and crowded all of that out, and it's hard to find those pieces of those meadows that are left where the wildflowers were as they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a lot of change there. I have noticed also that some of the higher mines, like at the bullion mine, which was the tunnels were opened there in the 1920 at the latest, were full of ice because they were high enough to be in the permafrost zone. Last time I was at the bullion, and there had been a little bit of slide activity, and I could look in one of the portals. It was about half full. It's melting.
Wow.
And also high on the mountain above the Gokord mine, the higher workings up there, there used to be a lot of ice, and it is not the continuous ice that it used to be. There is some seasonal ice, but so things are changing gradually, ever so gradually, yes.
So one of the recent articles that I came across pointed to some rather significant pollution problems, for example, in Beijing and China. And in that case, there was a point to all of the vehicular travel, the coal-burning power plants, et cetera, is being probably significant in causing this. And there have been some other examples of pollution, whether it's Fairbanks, which suffers from a severe inversion, and the difference is when you gather a lot of people together, an area that could survive doing certain things becomes less comfortable. And so we know, and I'm not wanting to go into the pollution area, except that when we last finished up, we were talking about the processing of the stuff that comes out of the mine. And we mentioned two substances which have been considered sometimes dangerous, mercury and cyanide.
Ah, right.
So they were used in fair amount in the processing. What's the situation with that? What was the situation then with people who were using those substances, and what's happening today?
The sodium cyanide, the process of discovering gold being relatively inert to acids and other things, you might want to try to dissolve it. There was a chemist that did a lot of work on trying to find something to dissolve gold, and it was an oddity that a weak solution of sodium cyanide will indeed take small particles of gold, and it will put them in the solution.
Wow.
This was, I think the story is actually the gentleman who did this was in his laboratory at home where he played. He was a druggist, and he was able to patent his process and make a lot of money with it back, oh gosh, this goes back to the turn of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So it caught on. There were people trying to find a way to keep from the expense of sending a concentrate to a smelter. Very expensive because of the freight and all of the handling. And
what would happen at the smelter?
The smelter, there were generally two processes, Mike, used in the Willow Creek District for recovering secondary recovery. The primary recovery was mercury. The amalgamation process, the secondary recovery, a lot of mines were able to use what was called a froth flotation process, where certain chemicals would cause the metals to float. It was confusing as sodium cyanide to try to explain this. There was a particular, can I tell the whole story? I mean,
sure. Go for it.
I'm stuttering here, trying to keep from telling the whole story. The story that's told, and it's probably one of these history things that are a little bit embellished over time, but a lady trying to do laundry, and her husband was a mechanic at a mine in Cripple Creek, Colorado, and his overalls were just miserable to try to clean, but she was determined to do it. One day she, whatever she had in pine oil or whatever, she was trying to wash his overalls. She noticed that all of the metal that had been in his clothes was floating in her washing machine. And not far away next door, there was a neighbor that was a mining engineer, and she had him come over and look at it. She was thought it was quite interesting, and he did too. So he found out what this guy had been working in, what kind of grease and oil and so on that he had. And from that was developed a general group of chemicals called xanthate. And what xanthate does is has the ability to create a surface tension phenomenon where the metals will indeed float on bubbles. So if you use a really tough bubble maker, trying to think of the name, pine oil, for example, if you don't have, there's a lot of metallurgical complications, but the simple form is that you use pine oil to make bubbles, use xanthate for the collector, and you can clean up the slurry that you're working with. You can clean all of the metal out of it. It'll all float. It'll be right there on the bubbles on the surface that are paddled off the top. And when the bubbles break, why, the metal all drops into, you're in a bin at that time.
Right.
You drain it, you sack it, you send it to a smelter. So there was a lot of people that were using that process. This is in the second phase of development of the Willow Creek Mining District. Remember, we're dividing that by World War I.
Okay.
So before, they didn't have this process. They didn't have, they had to stockpile everything essentially in tailing ponds, waiting for some discovery on how to do this. The other process was cyanide. Now, the the concentrate that you have from this process called froth flotation had to be sent to a smelter. The smelter of choice in Alaska during the 30s was the smelter at Tacoma, which was owned by Asarco. And it was primarily a copper smelter. Now, the ore that came out of the Kennecott operation would come to Cordova by train. A Alaskan steam ship would be loaded with that, and then it would not be completely loaded. It would then go down to Latouche Island, where there was another copper operation for a long time.
Oh, really?
Called the Beatson Mine. There were several mines, Beatson being the largest. It was owned by Kennecott also. And they would top off the load there with a concentrate that was also copper, but it was very siliceous. It had a lot of quartz in it, a lot of silica.
Okay.
Now, this made a perfect, as close as they could get anyway, perfect charge for a smelter. And the smelter was a batch process where you had a large container where that you would charge with the ore and with some way of heating it, either coke internally or else externally by a source of heat. You'd heat all of that to the melting point.
Okay.
Everything then has to flux. The quartz was used for fluxing the impurities. All the heavy metals would go to the bottom. So if you tapped the very bottom, you would be getting the gold and the silver. And then if you tapped a little higher, you would be getting the copper, et cetera. And the smelter process, it was a very environmentally degradatory type of a process because an awful lot of the impurities were sulfur. And the sulfur came off right up the chimney.
Wow.
Wow, yeah, wow indeed. There's some of the smelters around like Butte, Montana, and so on, where there's a dead zone of ringing. It used to be anyway. It's mm-hmm. coming back pretty well now. But Tacoma, same thing. Tacoma finally shut down for environmental reasons in the early 80s, middle 80s. But the ore from the Willow Creek District would go to Wasilla, be put on a train, be hauled down to Seward. Alaska Steamship would take it to the smelter, and it's very salacious also. We're talking quartz. So they'd love to have it. They there was no question that the smelter would take it.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the ore that would be sent down there would be handled in the smelter, charges that were being put together primarily for copper. You can imagine all the handling. These were put in bags that had filter paper liners because you wanted all of the moisture out of it that you could get. In fact, if you had too much moisture in it, you were not only paying freight for the moisture, but you'd get penalized by the smelter by having too much moisture.
Okay.
So you've got bags that have to be handled. And in those days, everything was handled by the longshoremen, stevedores, et cetera. So that there was a lot of hand labor involved in this, a lot of time, a lot of expense. So you'd finally get it down to the smelter, and the smelter would put it in a charge, and they would be assayed by the smelter. They would take enough samples that they could give you an idea. You had to have your own assayer because it wasn't wise to trust what they're doing. So you would have your own assayer. He'd come down and he'd do his sampling, and he'd come up with a number. If the two numbers didn't agree, then they had to hire a third one as an intermediary to come up with an answer. So all of these things are time involved and expensive. So, but on the other hand, those mines that were using cyanide, one of them that was using it as almost a primary recovery, it was secondary, but it was a big part of their recovery, was the Lucky Shot mine, the ladder milling that was taking place there, because there was some real serious complications with the metallurgy of the ore in the Lucky Shot. It had arsenic in it, and this created a lot of problems with amalgamation, etc. But you'd have to have several vats that you would fill up with, hopefully, a concentrate, not all of the ore that you're milling. You would try to concentrate it, usually with a heavy media, a table that was shaking, where the heavy particles would mm-hmm. be separated
sure.
from the light, so that you were treating a lesser volume. But the amount then that was separated out would go into a vat. It would be agitated in a solution, a weak solution of sodium cyanide. Now, a lot of the mines that originally had tailing ponds waiting for some new way of treating did their secondary treating later in their tailing ponds. And I remember eventually, Mike, I hope to get to the point where I'm going to be calling on a lot of stories that were given to me by Alan Horning. You'll remember the Horning name related to the Goldcorp mine, William and Pearl, and we'll be getting back to them. And their son, Alan, grew up in the Willow Creek District, mm-hmm. and he had all these fabulous memories of mm-hmm. what it was like. One of his memories was when they were cyaniding at the Maple Mine. And the cyanide came in kind of a tablet. It looked like a bar of soap. And you'd have to put that into solution. And it didn't want to go into solution. It was a pain in the backside. But eventually it would dissolve. You're talking about cold water. You know,
oh,
good
right.
grief. Yeah,
right.
You know, it'd take forever. Anyway, they weren't real clever about taking care of where they had these bars of sodium cyanide laying around. And he says one day he noticed that a squirrel came up, ground squirrel, and nibbled on one.
Oh.
And he says he turned around and walked about a half a foot, and it was all four legs straight up in the air. The squirrel came to an abrupt
end. Never had a chance.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, I never heard of any stories of any people. You'd think that they'd get splashed on, that they would get forget that their hands had it on it, whatever, and you'd have some horror stories about working in sodium cyanide, but I don't know any.
So you've mentioned three substances over time here, and we'll take them in alphabetical order: arsenic, cyanide, and mercury. Of the three, is there a way of judging which was most dangerous or most used or most left over?
Boy, that's a good question. there's so many determining factors. The arsenic that's in the rock naturally as a mineral, arsenopyrite, if you heat that, you don't have to melt it. If you just heat it, you can get fumes that'll do you in. You got to be careful with this stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, it's it'll turn you green first, and then you die. You know.
Okay.
Mercury. You hear an awful lot these days about being fearful of mercury. Most of that is related to Mercurius compounds, chemicals that contain not elemental mercury, but compounds of mercury.
Okay.
Because they can be mobilized into the food chain. You can metabolize them, and then you're in deep trouble. Elemental mercury, as it was used in the mines in the Willow Creek District for primary recovery, was always in very cold water, cold temperatures. The mobilization of elemental mercury, the history of it is phenomenal, Mike, because you find not that long ago, like 300 or 400 years, they used to inject people with mercury in their system. The good book, recent reading it's called A Death Decoded. It's a book about Robert Kennicott, the man for whom the Kennicott Glacier is named, and so on. His dad was a doctor, and he was a naturalist, and he spent a lot of time out in the wilderness, and he had a kit that was probably prepared by his dad as to medicines that he might need. In that was a little blue pill they used to take. This is not related to the little blue pill of
current day.
Nothing related to that, but they took... Back in the Civil War days, one of the people who were taking these little blue pills was Abraham Lincoln, of all things. It was elemental mercury. It was the main ingredient, and it was supposed to be good for counteracting depression and so on. Oh my gosh, you know, can you imagine ingesting elemental mercury? There's very little in the history related to that as to whether or not those people were terminated earlier than they would have been. In Kennicott's case, he took the pills because he had bouts of, I guess you'd call it depression. They called it ague, whatever that was. He took it. He died at a very young age, but of a heart attack. He had some real serious heart issues.
So, and if I remember correctly, there's a guy that wrote about the North, Jack London, who also died as a result of ingestion of some of these materials in an attempt to cure some problems that he had.
That rings a bell, but I can't remember the details.
I just happened to have been down to the Jack London State Park down in California with the remains of his house and a museum. And there's a box there. When you start talking about the box, there was a box that contained those small bottles, et cetera, that he had treated himself with. He had spent some time in the South Pacific in particular, and he had a series of ailments and he thought that this would be helpful to cure. And this is, of course, in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, a lot of people apparently were attempting to find ways to use these elements. One of the last ones, the cyanide.
The cyanide, yeah. And I, as used in the Willow Creek District, there's probably a lot of dead fish that floated down to the Cook Inlet out of the creeks and so on. But I cannot find any references to anybody that was, or you could determine that the cause of death was ingestion of cyanide. It's a very weak solution, and cyanide doesn't have a very long life. A lot of things deteriorate cyanide. Sunshine is a deteriorating factor. Ozone and so on deteriorates, and it's so weak that you have to go way out of your way to create a problem as used in the Willow Creek District.
Well, there's one topic we have not touched on, one other potential problem that some people have noted, in particular in basements, and that is radium. Anything at all? Because I'm thinking, oh, okay, you're digging into the ground, you're going down in the mine.
Yeah, that's a great question. I've often thought about that, Mike, especially like in my cabin.
Right.
Where I'm sitting not that high above solid rock that has a lot of deteriorating elements in it. Looking for the name of one of the minerals here that contains potassium, that is got several valence factors of potassium, some of which are deteriorating their low radioactivity,
mm-hmm.
and creating radium gas. And this radium gas then can find places where it can accumulate.
Mm-hmm.
In my cabin, I've got a wonderful heat exchanger. It's called a stovepipe.
Right. Okay.
And so I'm turning over the air in the cabin quite frequently. It's the old air is going up the chimney.
Sure.
And the new air is creeping in from all the cracks in the windows and around the doors and everything else. So I've never checked for radium. Underground, you've got a lot of natural ventilation that's probably keeping the numbers down. I've often wondered about entering a tunnel that has been blocked for the winter by snow.
Ah, yes.
And if you're first in, if you're too anxious to get in there without airing it out first, whether or not you might be ingesting without knowing it, there's simple ways of checking for it. I've just have never done it.
Okay. Well, Dan, as luck would have it, we have once again used up our time, although we've had what for me has been a fascinating walk through some interesting topics, particularly around arsenic, cyanide, mercury, and a little bit of radium gas.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's a vicious place out there, Mike.
Well, thank you again for coming in, and we'll pick up the story in our next interview.
Okay, thank you.